Good morning. Let's get straight to markets.
Take a look at the impact for the indices.
Factual. Succinct. All you need to know before your trading day starts. Subscribe to our newsletter, CNBC's Daily Open.
Beyond the Valley. Hello and welcome to Beyond the Valley, the podcast that explores the world of tech. I'm Tom Chitty and with me is CNBC's senior tech correspondent Arjun Karpal. This is not a revelatory statement. The world feels unstable right now. As wars wage on battlefields, countries are weaponizing the very things that were supposed to bring the international community together. Trade wars and rising protectionism are pulling countries apart. And next could be the internet, with cyberspace an increasingly important battleground for power, which may ultimately lead to a splinternet.
Beyond the Valley.
It's quite a bleak intro, to be fair.
That was pretty bleak, Tom.
Yeah.
But it's a very serious topic.
It is a serious topic, which we'll get into in a bit. But good to have you back in the studio, because it's been a while.
It's been a couple of weeks. First face-to-face one in a while.
Yeah.
Before we get into what is a very serious topic, I just want to say, if anyone's watching the social videos that we do, you can see the new microphone covers we've got. More merch.
Very snazzy.
After our mugs. Very cool. Yeah, let us know what you think.
Exactly. No, they look fantastic. So thank you to the...
It's really uplifted and professionalised this outfit, I think.
If it wasn't already professional enough.
Ultra professional now. New level.
Before we get into the main story for this week, we've obviously got to hear Arjun's stat of the week, which is...
5.4 billion people.
Okay.
See, I've quantified it a bit. Thought I'd just change the format, but usually I just throw out a number.
Yeah.
And now we're 5.4 billion people. So just get a bit more of a slight clue.
Yeah, I feel like maybe you've given too much this week.
Maybe.
We'll find out later.
Very careful, Tom.
Quickly, everyone fast forwards to the end. How much of an idiot is Tom? There we go. Okay, just to remind our listeners that if you have any questions on what we've discussed this week or past episodes, then you can email beyondthevalley@cnbc.com. But for now, back to our main story. Arjun, what's the state of play when it comes to a splinternet right now?
So one of the hardest things I think about this debate on the splinternet right now is trying to define exactly what it means. Now, this term's been around for a while, and I think broadly it's used to describe a world in which the internet as we know it, which is this sort of global interconnected communications system to some extent, becomes siloed in some ways, becomes blocked off in other ways. And there are different versions of the internet around the world, depending on where you go. So an example of that right now is China. You know, I lived there for a few years, and the internet in China is heavily censored. And also, just, I mean, if you looked, for example, on the phone screen that I used out there, the apps were completely different to the ones that I'd use in, say, being back in the UK or in Europe somewhere, or in the US. And that almost, that picture, sometimes I'd put the two phones side by side to see the difference in the screen. And that sort of gives you the idea of these varying degrees of splintering of the internet. Now, there are many ways, I think, that the splinternet or the splitting or sort of fracturing of the internet is happening. I think one is the banning of software and services. So, for example, if you're in China, there are many software and services like Google and Facebook that are blocked out there. There are export controls. So you've seen in the US, they're trying to limit the amount of certain semiconductors being exported to China. This is another type of, I think, sort of splinternet kind of view. And then there's the banning the use of hardware. For example, in China, they ordered government workers to stop using iPhones or other foreign hardware or technology. Again, if you're kind of in a situation where you're only allowed to use domestic or certainly approved hardware like phones, that creates another level of splintering of the internet, given that these phones are connected to the internet most of the time. And so these are ways we're seeing it right now. And I think defining it is quite difficult still, but there's many views as to what exactly it is.
China's also not the only country that has sort of tried to adopt its own intranet, shall we call it. So Iran, being another country, has created infrastructure to have a national intranet. I use intranet because it's kind of what it is. It's no longer sort of interconnected. It's sort of within its own house.
Yeah, it's a good way to put it.
And then Russia as well, seemingly getting closer to moving to having its own intranet, which has been named the RuNet. When we talk about these various intranets, is that something that we should really be concerned about? Why is that bad?
Yeah, there's lots of byproducts of a splintering or fracturing, I think, of the internet. And one of those that could be detrimental, I think, is the access to information. So one of the great things about the internet is you go online and you're able to just learn something, right? Now, obviously, you're not going to say all the information online is accurate, but there's, you know, trusted sources and things like that. You can go and find out information online. Now, some of the countries you've named, Russia, China, Iran, you know, many see them as authoritarian regimes, and they feel that in those countries, those governments need to control the flow and access to data. Now, again, in China, you go on Google, doesn't exist. Page does not exist when you go on Google.com out there. And also, the search engines there are heavily censored as well. So anything the Chinese government finds sensitive or offensive won't turn up on a search engine. And so when you talk about access to information in a world where there's sort of a bifurcated internet, and particularly in countries with strict internet controls, that access to information is limited. That global internet is not accessible. So you can't see things that... And that leads to misinformation.
But it's also not the sort of premise that the World Wide Web was sort of built on. You know, you've interviewed Tim Berners-Lee, the guy who created the World Wide Web, and his whole purpose for creating it was to actually share information between researchers, right? And if we are moving away from that, that's not what it was intended to do.
No, exactly. Away from its original purpose. So that sort of global platform starts to fracture. And so, you know, you and I, right? I mean, another example is, you know, access to services, right? You and I right now could shop on Chinese-based shopping websites if we wanted to.
Like Alibaba.
Like AliExpress, their international version. But what happens in a world where you don't have access to those services, and other people in other countries may not have access to services as well, you might find yourself cut off as well. So those are two ways, two sort of real-world examples. Now, TikTok, right? TikTok's a good example. We are currently in a debate where the US is planning or debating whether ByteDance, the Chinese owner of TikTok, needs to sell off TikTok in the US. And if it doesn't do so, it will effectively face a de facto ban. We spoke about this on last week's episode. Again, your access to services, you know, many people use TikTok, millions and millions of people use TikTok. Your access to services go in a world of a bifurcated internet.
Obviously, we've got the authoritarian regimes doing, you know, restricting access to information, restricting, you know, a free and open internet. But also we're seeing it in the West, and, you know, they're using it to beat the other one over the head with, right? I'm going to take away, you know, access to all these consumers that use your internet product. So it's not just a authoritarian regime. The US is doing it clear as day.
Yeah, that's a great point, Tom. That's exactly the point. This is not about just China or Russia sort of creating these intranets. You are seeing it in the US. You're seeing it in Europe as well. And I think it comes down to the role of geopolitics here, right? The internet and technology are increasingly seen as strategic importance to many, many countries, right? You've seen it in the semiconductor space. You're now beginning to see it more and more in the internet services space as well. And there's few motivations, and it depends on the country, right? If you look at China and Russia, it's very much about controlling access to information and controlling what people are seeing. If you look at something like a region like the European Union, here it's all about data concerns. The European Unions are very concerned about the way that EU citizen data is being used by these internet services. And what they're requiring more and more is EU data to be stored on EU shorts. So there's this kind of data silos that are emerging as well. And for the US and the EU as well, it's all about competition. You know, part of what the US is trying to do with TikTok is about user data, yes. But I think it's also about they have, and for a long time, the US has had the biggest internet companies in the world. And all of a sudden, you've got this disruptor coming along, taking on the likes of Facebook and Instagram and other social media platforms there. So part of this, perhaps, is also about backing the homegrown competition as well, and hoping that those homegrown tech firms remain competitive. So the Splinternet, as we see it today, isn't just being driven, like you said, out of countries like China and Russia. Part of that is also being driven out of the US and the European Union.
And between each other, you know, it's not just about countries that are seemingly at conflict with each other. It's countries which are seen as friends, but they're also protecting their own companies and technology. I mean, if you look at Google's Bard, the chatbot, it was available in 180 countries, but not in the EU until recently. And many saw that as them sending a message to the EU that, you know, this is not a very friendly environment when it comes to regulation for tech companies. So is it that we're in a position where the maelstrom of barriers and hurdles that tech companies will have to increasingly navigate is just not worth it?
Well, yeah, it certainly is that. And I think the sort of almost bifurcation of the internet between the EU and US is becoming more and more real as well. The Bard example is a great one. And it goes back actually about more than a decade or so. So for a long, long time, the EU and the US had a data sharing agreement where the EU was like, yes, you can send EU data to the US to process it. And that's important because if you're an American company who has users in the EU, you often what you need to do is send that data back to your data centers in the US to deliver services, et cetera. And this is what Facebook has done for many, many, many years and Google and others. In, I think, the early 2010s, there was a guy called Edward Snowden. Many might have heard of him, many not. He was a former employee at the National Security Agency, the NSA, in the US, and eventually turned a whistleblower and revealed a bunch of stuff about the NSA's sort of spy tactics. And in the mid 2010s, Max Schrems, he was an Austrian or is an Austrian privacy campaigner, said that because of all these revelations, the EU-US data sharing agreement at the time didn't protect EU citizen data when it was sent to the US. Because he argued, well, if the NSA is carrying out all these sort of spy things and EU data was going to the US, how is the EU data safe? And so in 2015, Europe's top court ripped up the agreement, which at the time was called the Safe Harbor Agreement, and it was no longer valid. It was replaced a little bit later by something called the Privacy Shield, which was also struck down on very similar terms. Now there's an agreement in place called the Data Privacy Framework, and this allows US companies to send European data to the US for processing, but there needs to be safeguards in place. And these are really important because companies like Meta said, without these data sharing agreements, we may have to stop Facebook in Europe, for example. And so you can see there, while that hasn't happened yet, you can start to see the differences in countries and regions between the internet. And, you know, there is realistically a world where the EU says, look, Meta, we don't trust that you can send data back to the US, and so all of it's got to be stored here. And Meta may say, we can't do that because we can't deliver our services, so we can't really give you a full experience for Facebook. There are those realistic possibilities. As I said, it hasn't happened yet, but we've been close. And so again, this is an EU-US issue, not to do with China, not to do with Russia or any other country. And so you are seeing those sort of patterns emerge and those data silos emerge as well. One of the big stories is really around this idea of data sovereignty. You may hear this a lot recently, but it's the idea that countries want their citizen data to be stored in that country. You've seen it in China a few years ago. They made Apple store Chinese citizen data in China. The EU has a similar push right now. And so those data silos are going to continue. Of course, it gets more expensive for companies because they need data centers here and there and everywhere as well. And so it's going to be interesting to see whether this kind of, well, it will raise the cost of business, but whether this is enough to sort of motivate companies to be, to say, you know what, I don't want to operate here or I don't want to operate in this country.
Yeah, or whether it's financially worth it to be a global platform, right? You know, okay, let's not, you know, get the violin out for Facebook. The company has done very well over the last several decades. But it is something to consider. Are we, will we be globally connected through those social platforms, you know, as we once were? Or are we now seeing a decline on that front? The other thing I wanted to touch on, Huawei. Let's talk a little bit about Huawei and its own operating system. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think that's another good story that illuminates this point around a bifurcating internet. So mobile phones, two dominant operating systems, right? Google's Android and Apple's iOS. That's been the status quo for a long, long time now in the smartphone space. But a few years ago, Huawei launched its own mobile operating system called Harmony OS, and that was because US sanctions forced Google to cut ties with Huawei. So for a long time, Huawei was using Google's Android operating system, both inside and outside of China. You know, a sort of forked version of Android in China. And, you know, it was the biggest smartphone player in the world for a while. And now, for the past few years, it's been sort of improving and building on its own Harmony OS system. And reportedly, it's going to release sort of a new version, independent this version, this year, which has nothing to do with Android. It's completely different. It's completely based on a different core, all of these kind of things. And they're getting a lot of Chinese companies to build apps for the operating system. We all know, like, when you go onto the App Store in on the iPhone or Google Play, you can get all the apps you need. And so that's key to any operating system being successful as well. So you're seeing a completely different operating system emerge in China. And what would be interesting to see is whether Huawei gets enough traction for this that actually other smartphone makers in China begin to say, actually, you know what? We may just use Huawei's OS in China because it's designed for the Chinese market. It's got all the apps. It works well, rather than using kind of a forked version of Android. And so, and outside of China, maybe they'll use Android. But I very much doubt this operating system is going to be able to be, at least in the near term, successful outside of China. That's because it's unlikely to have a lot of American apps on it. You know, the apps we all use, Netflix and Facebook and Instagram and WhatsApp and whatever else, it's unlikely to have those on them. But I think politically, a lot of these companies will find it tough to put their apps on Huawei's app store. But it's an example of the splintering of the internet. If you're in China, you buy a Huawei phone, you've got Harmony OS on it. You come to Europe, you're like, oh, I need to download, I don't know, I need to download Google Maps.
City Mapper.
Or something, yeah. Or I need to, you know, get on WhatsApp to do business or whatever, that might become increasingly difficult to do. Just as, you know, it's quite difficult to take your foreign phone into China and download, you know, apps that are banned there or effectively blocked there. If you're, you know, on a local Wi-Fi network, for example.
Subscribe to the Squawkbox Europe Express podcast. Join Steve, Karen, and myself, Arabile, in unscripted and dynamic debate around the day's top stories with first and exclusive interviews of the best in business and global newsmakers, original points of view and instant analysis of the latest business news and key market themes. Get set for the day ahead. Squawkbox Europe Express podcast, now available on Spotify, Apple Music, and Google Podcasts.
In a sort of future scenario, could you theoretically see people switching between operating systems? Obviously, the rise of VPNs, I want to touch on that a little bit as well, because we know that, you know, VPNs are used around the world to get around some of these barriers. Are we going to be seeing an different processes, people using VPNs all the time to get around these. And are we going to be switching between operating systems as well, depending on what country, what region we're in?
It's a horrible world, that, isn't it?
Sounds stressful.
Stressful, painful. And that, I think, is what it boils down to when we talk about the splinternet, is we have been so used to, so long, the ease of use of the internet. Apps, phones, everything's easy. And
it's been made to be easy for you.
It's been made to be easy.
Hence our addictive nature towards our smartphones.
Yeah.
But then that may be about to change.
That may be about to change. And I don't want to get too into the weeds on it, but technology revolves around standards, right? Standards are what allows, for example, you, Tom, to take your phone from here and, you know, using the 4G network or 5G network in London, and then head to under the US and be able to just immediately use their network if you wanted to, you know, pay the roaming charges or whatever. That's what allows it, because there's global standards around 4G, 5G, and there's global standards around certain technologies. And so the key, one of the things that may start to happen is that these global standards that dictate our technologies begin to diverge on geopolitical lines, and various other lines. And that's when we get into a situation where things get harder. Interoperability between things get harder. So that's a real danger, for sure. I think another issue is, just as you said, like they're switching between different operating. That's going to be so hard. And I don't think it's going to be possible.
Because those phones are going to be fitted out to accommodate a certain operating system and not multiple. I mean, that's the world we live in today. That might change.
And exactly. And I think it's going to, you will see the internet, I think, start to fracture. It already has started to fracture along political lines, you know, depending on what the geopolitical tensions are like, what the tech tensions are like, where the battle for tech supremacy between China and the US lies at this point, where the EU sees its role and fits in. All of these things are going to be something that are going to dictate what the state of the internet and, you know, the splintering of the internet looks like. I mean, one thing you've seen is Chinese companies, given that the US market and other markets are generally shut to many of them, they have looked to places like Latin America, like Africa, to expand as well. You see Huawei and other companies doing just that. And so as Chinese tech companies begin to expand into some of these other regions, do they take their operating systems, their standards with them there? Is there a world in which Huawei's Harmony OS, for example, becomes the de facto sort of dominant operating system in, I don't know, one of those regions like Latin America or Africa, and, you know, Android effectively gets pushed out? I don't know, but these are the considerations when you think about it, as you think about sort of the bifurcation of the internet.
It's also hard to sort of down tools or down weapons, shall we say, and just everyone take a minute, because the rate of development that tech has, and companies just pushing and trying to innovate all the time, it's so hard to say, well, can we just stop and just try and sort out the rules a bit? It's like playing, you know, a football game, but no one knows the rules, but everyone's just, they know one rule, and that's to score the goal. And no one's managing that situation, so it's chaos.
Yeah, it is.
One other thing I want to talk to you about is subsea cables. I know it's a bit random, but when we talk about the internet, I don't know if anyone knows, but most of the internet, or the data that supports the internet between countries, goes under the sea and not in the sky. That, you know, you may think, oh, it's a satellite, but actually much of it goes in subsea cables, which are hugely important, as you'd imagine, and are supported by private enterprise as well as countries' own funding. And as we talk about the internet being a sort of a weapon to be used against one another or to be utilized in a power struggle, that sort of core infrastructure is increasingly becoming, you know, important and threatened by its importance, if that makes sense. So I know that, you know, a few organizations have threatened to cut cables between countries. I actually went to a subsea cable station.
Did you?
Once. Yeah.
Where?
Pretty sure it's Burnham-on-Sea. I can't give you the exact location.
Oh, secret. Top secret.
Well, we weren't given access. This was very much us going to have a look.
Oh, okay.
And we were filming a piece to camera outside and we essentially got chased down the street.
This was in the UK?
This was in the UK. So I just wanted just to give you a picture of how secretive and important these things are.
That's amazing. What did the subsea cable station look like?
It looked like you would walk past, you would just think it's a utility state, probably a power, something for the power grid.
Yeah.
You know, waste management, like, it was totally nondescript. There was no signage, nothing.
Wow. And you got chased down the street.
We were on the road, on the other side of the road, and these people came out of the gate, quite scary looking, big blokes. And we sort of casually started walking away like we hadn't noticed them until they got very close. And we went back to our car and they were like, you know, effing and blinding and it's quite nerve-wracking. Wow. Actually, and what it must be like to be a spy. It's not,
I mean, you'd be a rubbish spy if you stood there across the street filming. That's not ideal.
Pretty gave the game away.
I think it's a good point. I would say I would urge our listeners to actually, you know, do a quick read on subsea cables, because they are incredibly important to the infrastructure of our internet.
Absolutely. But before we finish the episode, we got to do, of course, Stat of the Week.
Tom, Stat of the Week, 5.4 billion people. Don't look at my notes.
You know, you're holding up a piece of paper and it's sort of see-through as well. So
well, that's not good, is it? I'll do the classic school covering. Just covering the hand.
5.4 billion, the number of internet users in the world.
Yes. Yes, the number of people now online, according to the International Telecommunication Union, the ITU, which is under the UN, did you know that's 67% of the global population, which I think is interesting, because you think, you know,
everyone uses
the internet. And I think, you know, being in obviously like a very developed country like the UK, you know, you have the privilege to be able to have access to the internet, but there's so many people around the world who don't.
Yeah, it is. And the move to be cashless and to sort of just every, you know, I don't know about you, but I use my phone for everything, right? You know, I don't carry cash, I don't carry cards anymore.
No.
But for, you know, a third of the world's population, that's just not a thing.
And I think that's why connecting, you know, people are so important. Connecting people to the internet is so important, because, you know, there are all these advantages they're getting left behind on. And I think that's why there's such this big push to sort of globally connect the internet. And I think back to our topic, throwing in the bifurcation of the internet does present potential problems to connecting people globally.
And the money that is required to do that, if it's not going to be profitable, to counter that argument, this whole problem we have with data, we may see less concern around our data being used everywhere and anywhere. And we may have a little bit more control over it. So
there's pros and cons. There's many stories.
Look at us, just sitting on the fence.
Just sitting on the fence. Love it. It just got all a bit philosophical there at the end. But it's one of those topics, isn't it? That it's just a debate that will continue.
Absolutely.
And I reckon you'll see this debate. It's not actually, I don't think it's really hit the mainstream yet, this debate. I don't think it's really kind of out there as a key risk or issue. But I think it's something that we should certainly be watching very, very closely. And I know a lot of people who are, or likely a lot of people in government positions and looking at competition policy are definitely watching this kind of debate play out.
Brilliant. Okay, that's it for this episode. But before we go, please follow and subscribe to the show, and you can rate us. And remember, if you want to email us, it's beyondthevalley@cnbc.com. Thank you, Arjun.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll be back next week for another episode of Beyond the Valley. Goodbye.
Beyond the Valley.